This is another iRaw podcast.
So how this program has moved from a lens, which is from a point where they were talking about controlling the population, controlling rabies as a health factor. So these factors are still there. Another level has come across, which is cleaning the city spaces in accordance with the upper middle class and above classes in these urban areas, in these cities.
Welcome back to the final episode of season 3 of The Animal Tome, which is focused on animals and the urban. I think we've had a really good season of unpacking some of the important concepts related to the urban. There are so many more I would have liked to have, you know, spoken about, things like urban ecology, urban arcs, novel ecosystems. But of course, there's only so much you can talk about in a single season. And I think that we've done a fairly good job of touching on some of the most important themes and ideas currently circulating scholarship related to animals and the urban, as well as pointing to how important the urban is as a space for considering and thinking about not only the lives of animals inside cities, but as well as those outside of them. So urban areas are really important spaces, and I hope that that's become clear throughout the season. Before I introduce today's guests for the grad review, I just wanted to say thank you once again to Animals in Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. A particular thank you to Sue Donaldson and Will Kimlicker for all their guidance and their support since the beginning of launching this podcast. I really don't think I could have done it without them. So just a thank you there. I also wanted to point out that if you have any ideas for future seasons of The Animal Turn, I'm now starting to develop other sponsorship relationships. The next season, which I'll speak a bit about at the end of this episode, has some sponsors, yay, in addition to Apple. And it's really an exciting opportunity, I think, to work with other research groups on developing a season that kind of focuses in on particular themes and ideas, as well as potentially opening up opportunities for grad students. If you've got some ideas for future seasons and ways in which we could potentially collaborate, or ways in which your research institute could sponsor a season, that would be really amazing. Feel free to reach out to me to continue that conversation. info@theanimaltermpodcast.com. And also, I just wanted to write here at the end, say, please feel free to use these podcasts and particular episodes or whole seasons as tools in the classroom. If you are a teacher or a lecturer and you think that these ideas are useful for your students, please put them in your syllabi as supplementary material and let me know. Let me know how it goes. If it is useful, if your students respond to these episodes, this is kind of where my goal is, seeing this podcast as a pedagogical tool. Let's move on. Today's episode is already really long and I don't want to keep you too much, but we had a really good conversation, and the guests today in my grad review are both PhD candidates with the ERC grant project Urban Ecologies at the National Institute of Advanced Studies in Bangalore. Through their work, they are attempting conversations between ethnographic and ethological perspectives of thinking about animals. And we talk a fair bit about this in today's episode. In fact, almost the first half of the episode is kind of dedicated to speaking a bit about their work, as well as some of the gaps that we found in the season. Shubhangi Srivastava's PhD work is primarily centered on understanding human-dog relationships in urban India, whereas Anmol Chaudhuri's work is focused primarily on monkeys. We delve into a whole bunch of different concepts and ideas, and I think we really get into a big stride in the last third of the interview, where we're really just kind of riffing off one another and thinking about some of these ideas and how they could be used in future urban scholarship. Let's get started straight away with finding out a little bit about both of you. So I know that you're both working on a project together, actually, so it's kind of fun to have you here. Could you possibly both tell us a little bit about yourselves as well as the project that you're working on?
I'm currently working on the monkeys. I'm working with monkeys in the cities of Delhi and Guwahati in India. So a larger project, I think, as Shubhangi will also tell you, we have two other people with us in the project. With the four of us, we're kind of looking at urban ecologies in India, in Indian cities, Global South. That's the kind of focus. And the four of us have different focus animal groups. So I kind of look at the monkeys, Shubhangi is kind of looking at dogs. Two of our other friends, they're looking at cattle and the smaller animal husbandry animals such as chickens, pigs, goats. So this is what the larger project is about. And where I kind of featured in is I was, you know, after my master's, I completed my master's in anthropology. So I was trying to look at certain opportunities where I might be able to do some work with animals, not per se in the urban, but where I might see certain kinds of gaps and especially around policy circles. I was wondering if I can, you know, go there. But then this opportunity came in and I just, you know, kind of applied for it. And the project sounded really, really exciting. And so this is how I kind of, you know, got absorbed into the project. And though I have a zoology and an anthropology background, so I kind of, I was very conflicted about how to kind of approach this work. I've done some ethnographic work during my master's, but altogether I had, you know, a technical training in zoology during my bachelor's. So this project
was really useful. That's amazing.
Precisely. So this project in that sense was also innovative. It wanted to be more innovative. So I think it became a space where I could kind of have this conversation between, you know, zoology, anthropology, and then really learn about the geographical theory, which is altogether new to me. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think you did say it, this is part of your PhD now.
Precisely.
This project, for all of you, you are PhD students that are working on these different animals.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. That's incredible. Sometimes I feel like that's something I miss as a PhD student in animal studies, is having fellow PhD students to work with, right?
Right.
To kind of think through these problems, because they are complicated. And the fact that you have both anthropology and zoology in your realm of interest and knowledge is just amazing, because I think it can sometimes feel a bit overwhelming when you're trying to grapple with animal studies and you need to know the politics, you need to know the mm-hmm. economics, you need to know yeah. biology, you need to know a variety of things, and
yeah.
and you it can really feel crazy sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's incredible. That's so interesting. And what year are you in now?
So we're in our fourth year of our PhD. Basically, this is supposed to be the writing phase, you know, but the past year and a half stalled some of our fieldwork programs.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of couldn't really keep up with those. So there are some commitments that we're kind of chasing right now, and finishing some of those, you know, interviews, very, very mandatory interviews in the cities, speaking to certain officials, you know, and making some observations with our, you know, focal animals that we have. So kind of finishing that up, then kind of get into this writing mode. Hopefully, we'll get done, you know, by next year, August. That's what the aim is.
Amazing. Amazing. Me too. I'm hoping to be done by next year, August, okay?
So yes.
This time next year, the three of us need to meet back and
yeah.
be like, how are you doing?
Yeah.
and be kind to each other,
absolutely.
I think.
Absolutely.
Shubhangi, maybe you can step in now and tell us a little
yes.
bit. So we've got a kind of a sense of the project now, but maybe a bit of how you came to be in this project, involved in the work you're doing.
Yeah, so it's very interesting that we both are here together. Me and Anmol are here in this podcast because we go way back a bit.
Yeah.
We are both from the same department of anthropology before we joined the PhD. Although we did not know each other, we were from different batches, but
yeah.
we met during the PhD interviews and everything. And you're like, oh, we're from the same department. Yeah, so same thing. Like I did my anthropology and I became interested in studying primates. Was primate behavior was one of the subjects we were taught in my master's, and that was an interesting point. And but it was more of understanding the evolutionary histories and behaviors of primates. And I followed that up in my MPhil in anthropology from the same University mm-hmm. of Delhi. And from there, like I was interested in this project because I was already studying human-animal relations during my MPhil. I was working as a research associate and I was in the field collecting data about it and working towards my dissertation on human-macaque interactions. And I was interested in that, and then Fortunately, I came across this project, which is about like the official name of the project is Urban Ecologies Governing Non-Human Living in Cities. So yeah, so we are under the project. We are looking at two cities, as Anmol said, Delhi and Guwahati, which are Delhi is more of a central capital city in India, and Guwahati is an eastern city, which is which could be called an upcoming urban center in the eastern India. So we are sort of looking at urbanization and how non-human animals are living in these urban centers in the global south. And in the global south itself, also we are looking through a comparative lens, we are understanding this concept about urban animals in these two cities. So the prior to COVID, the plan was to do like 1 year in Delhi, 1 year in Guwahati, and then have a comparative data set to see the lives of non-humans in these two cities. But now we are adjusting as everyone to these new norms in our work. Yeah, so I mean, ideally our work, our field work should have been over, but we have maybe 2 months more to tie up some loose ends in Guwahati, and then it will be full-fledged writing mode for our PhD.
Amazing. And you're focused on dogs now.
Yes. So my my work is for my for this project and towards the PhD. I'm studying street dogs specifically. So, and I'm looking, I'm combining two methods of behavioral observations from ethology and ethnographic observations from anthropology to look at, to study the lives of dogs in interactions with humans in these two cities. So like I usually follow the dogs and they lead me to whoever they want to. And then I talk to them or look at how they are maneuvering through the city or living their life and like every day, what they're doing, how they're doing, what decisions they're making, what they're eating, why they're eating that, where they're going, where they're sleeping. Yeah. And like who they are interacting with, their own species, humans, other species, cows. Whoever is there, and like even the cars and inanimate objects around them, how they're interacting with them, it brings out a very interesting aspect of their life, which I feel is very important. That's what I'm trying to look at and include.
I'm really happy to have you guys here because we haven't really spoken, I think, in depth in this season, actually, about ecology. And urban ecology kind of came up several times in the interviews. And in the previous season, in season two, we spoke a bit about cognitive ethology. But here we could have, I think, also grappled with what does ethnography look like in the urban? What are some of the methods that folks could use to understand urban animals? And in hindsight, you know, you can't fit everything, of course, into 10 episodes. But I think having some sense of what these methods are, like how do you, we talk about the significance and the importance of seeing these urban animals, but how do we go about viewing their lives or analyzing their lives? And I think some of the work you two are doing with regards to like melding ethology and ethnography and ecology, all the E words, the triple E's, I think it's kind of at the forefront of research right now with animals in the urban, right?
I mean, I'm absolutely terrified doing this work because, you know, because there's no sense of clarity in what, you know, what we're really doing, because we know the questions, we know what we're asking, we know, and now that we've been in the field, we know what the field, you know, sort of looks like. But to really, you know, it all boils down to how are we really kind of trying to bring out those perspectives, specifically kind of focused around the animal itself, you know, what the animal is, what is the animal really doing in the city, you know? I mean, of course, there can be very, very anthropocentric descriptions of what the animal is doing. But how do you kind of either minimize those anthropocentric effects, or do you detach yourself from that practice of writing in a particular way? How do you kind of do that? So I think for each one of us, it's different because we are all different people, one. But then we're also dealing with different animals themselves. Then we're also interacting with different kinds of people who the animals interact with. So in effect, you know, it's all, you know, it's extremely different and variable and so uncertain that it's scary. That, you know, are we really doing what we are doing, and does it really make sense? And, you know, and this is me. I'm supposed to be in the fourth year, clearly, but mentally, I don't think that I'm quite there. You know,
I'm happy I'm not alone. I'm happy I'm not the only one entering my fourth year feeling like, what the hell am I doing? I mean, it sounds like you guys have a pretty good grip on things, so I wouldn't be too worried. But yeah, I can totally relate to kind of that fear of, you know, of there's a lot of responsibility also in looking at these animals. I think a lot of us come to doing this research because we care about animals, right? We care about the ways in which they're treated. And our research has implications. And especially at the PhD level, I think you start to feel the weight of that. But yeah, it's a lot to contend with.
Yeah, so like just to add like what Anmol was saying, it's definitely terrifying to understand how and what are we going to do. I mean, initially when we started in Delhi with our fieldwork, we knew that we have to bring together two different methods. We knew that we have to study these animals with our questions, which haven't been done actually in the field. They have been theoretically understood. We have read up on these things in papers, but going to the field and with in a very different setting altogether, like in Delhi, and then again then moving to Guwahati, which is again a very different culture, very different ecology. Then and how do we do it? It's very difficult. But then also it comes before we go to writing with each animal. I think all four of us, we faced a different methodological challenge. That we went to our field with certain, like for instance, if I'm telling you, take an example from my own work. I went to the field with a certain behavioral observations, how to do it. I had an idea from before what method, what software to use, how to go about the ethogram. But when the areas which I was dealing with in Delhi, the animal which I was dealing with, these settings were so different that the plan I had totally failed there. So the interactions were happening so quickly that if I had stuck to the previous plan, I would have missed on a lot of things. I have to literally run after the dogs for like kilometers because they're chasing some other dog for that long out of their territory. So yeah, and at that time you can't just like you can't absorb so many things which are happening around you. You can't enter all those data entry points into your software at that point. So I just moved on to, okay, at this point I just want to see what is happening, record what is happening, and then later go on and analyze it. So I think these are things which you come across with these even new methods which we are trying to do, where we are trying to combine ethology, ethnography, or ecology. Even within that, we had a lot of challenges. And this is what I also felt like during the season. These things came up, like the methods to study urban animals. They did come up in instances where, like, Michelle Westlake, and she was talking about ant colonies observations, or Marcus Bainsrock was talking about his study about hyenas and the ethnographic approach he took. But I felt that these were left out and they were quite open-ended. And possibly this is something I felt nice that, okay, this is some, if we are in this episode, we could maybe contribute towards that gap which was in the season. And I think, yeah, these methods are very important to talk about at the moment, because urban animals, we are studying them. We have moved on towards the animal turn to studying these animals. But how to do it when a researcher actually reaches the field? I think that's a big problem that a lot of us are facing. So I think a discussion about that is very important.
Yeah, I mean, it is something Marcus brought up in the episode. You know, he was also a student who just kind of showed up in a city. He was completely outside of his own, you know, cultural and geographical location and had to kind of figure it out. Yeah, and speaking about methods is kind of like the background noise. You know, we all read these really exciting, interesting papers about theory, and sometimes you need to actually just get to the nuts and bolts of like, how do I do this, and how do I do this ethically? Right. Yes. So that was also something that that came up a fair bit with Michelle as well, where she said, you know, she would start to observe, or she would start to do tests and start to, you know, confine some animals as a way of trying to understand design. And through that process, she started to actually have ethical quandaries. Like, is this appropriate? And I think starting to speak about these is the right way to go, right?
Absolutely.
So maybe before we start talking a bit about the themes between some episodes, which I think we're doing now already, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the methods that you've been using, because you said they're like enter data points and stuff, and this seems foreign to me, right? So to me, ethnography at least is, you know, going and just doing deep observations, taking down notes. And Anmol, you mentioned, you know, we all write differently. Like, ethnography is in some respects a very immersive, reflective
Absolutely.
Practice where you write down your observations, and sometimes you're not even sure exactly what you're observing until you reflect and you look at your notes again. But coming from the primarily social side of research, I don't think I would ever use words like data points, right, to think about this. So, and I actually didn't even know what you were talking about when you were like, and then I just need to enter the data points. So what does that mean? What are you guys doing when you're observing your animals in your cities?
So I'll just clarify this word. So when I'm observing an interaction, so there'll be an interactor who's initiating the interaction. There'll be a recipient who is on the receiving end of that interaction, and there'll be the interaction itself. So these, with the help of ethogram, which are developed extensively on different and are different for every animal which are being studied, and so based on that, there are certain codes of interactions, and then you can break down a particular interaction. Say a human is feeding one of my focal animals at night. So that's one of my focal animals. So a human feeding a focal night. So that would be my interaction. We will have codes, and that would be make one data point. And then each data point, which would also have certain contributing factors about the weather, or how many people are around that specific area where the interaction is happening, which other dogs of the same pack are nearby, which other dogs of the other pack are nearby, when this interaction is happening. And so these all contribute to one data point. And based on these several entries, you get a data set on which you analyze. And then, so this is a very crisp way of explaining what how I'm doing observations, but there are softwares which ecological softwares where which you can use right away to for these entries in the field. Like for example, I was using HandyBase, which is one of the softwares, but it became very difficult at that moment when the dog was interacting, and it could be easier if you're very much adapted to that, to entering data or to that software. But as I said, I'm not so good with technology. So maybe that's one of the drawbacks or the bias which was there. So I couldn't do that at the moment. I wanted to look at what was happening. And then also there are people who these were very densely populated areas where I was studying. So every time I'm standing there with my phone, with my laptop, I'm sort of an outsider in that community, in that area. So almost every minute or two, a person would come up to me and ask me, what are you doing? What are you studying here? What are you doing? They're very much interested in my work. And those were actually very rich interactions which I used to have with such people who were interested in my work. And then they would get to know that, oh, you're studying dogs. Nobody has ever studied dogs. Why are you studying dogs? And they just start these questions which they pose to me, they just start make them think also about the dog, which they might not have before. And then these interactions conversations did give me a lot of interesting insights into how and what people were thinking about these dogs in their area. So I think this way I could connect the two methods.
I think for me it was slightly different because So when I was working on my dissertation, there was a small brief dissertation during my BSc in zoology, and the only thing that finally kind of fascinated me was observing animals. And I realized, I mean, I was very, I mean, the only reason I took zoology was because, you know, I was like, oh, cells, very interesting. And I was very interested in cells and understanding cell biology and the kind of metabolic pathways and so on and so forth. But then I was like, oh, you know, I'm sitting here in the lab and, you know, it's not becoming as fascinating as I thought it would in due course. And then slowly, by the end, you know, the final year, there was one paper on animal behavior. And I kind of looked at that and I was like, oh, you know, this is really interesting. This is something that interests me because it's talking to the evolutionary theory. It's talking to, you know, observing animals, what they're really doing. And that's something that I've personally always done because there've always been animals around wherever I've lived, you know, across India. And, you know, there've always been cows, there've always been crows, there've always been sparrows. You'll have small centipedes walking in at any point. You know, all of these insects, from insects to birds to larger mammals and to living around areas where you also have, you know, the Himalayan bears coming down, you know, whenever they feel like, leopards, you know, snow leopards, you know, coming down. And so there have been animals coming in and around human habitation. And so those were certain kinds of triggers. But I was not very happy with the methods that were used specifically within zoology, because they were in some way, they wanted to quantize the behavior. They wanted to measure something, you know. And it was precisely for that reason I kind of moved from zoology to anthropology, because I thought, you know, maybe anthropology will give me that flexibility, you know, that kind of edge. Those books that I've heard of where people have written about just, you know, one of the most mundane activities, you know, the everyday activities, but they're still interesting to read because you read such descriptions of those, you know, activities. Why not kind of do something that like that with animals? And so I kind of moved from there to this anthropology. Then I got interested in primates because anthropology would only study primates. They wouldn't be interested in anything else. So, and finally coming down to this project then, the first few months I was so troubled by how am I really going to do this? How am I really going to get that, you know, data from the field? How am I really going to observe monkeys? Because what I had previously done during my master's thesis was, you know, very typical ethological quantitative methods. You make the ethogram and, you know, you have certain behaviors that you've described. Then you see at what intervals do those behaviors kind of happen. And then you also have a time interval within which you lose. You know, you're not supposed to observe the animal because you're only observing them at those particular timestamps. And so you're essentially losing 15 minutes or 20 minutes in an hour, depending on what kind of interval you've kept. So that slightly troubled me. And then I thought, you know, can we kind of do more of an ethnography? Can we really call it an ethnography? Because there was some sort of hesitation that we received from anthropologists within India. People we spoke to, they were like, oh, you know, no, you don't do anthropology with, you know, this ethnography with animals. It's supposed to entirely be with humans. You can speak to them and so on and so forth. So, you know, it opened like this entire box, which has already been open for like years, you know, what animals can do and what animals can't.
Ethnos means humans, you can't do.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And so now what I'm really doing in the field, and I've finally become confident, you know, of what I'm really doing now by the end of third year, I am just following troops of monkeys initially, just, you know, doing nothing. Go wherever they go, you know, and just follow them, interact with whoever they interact with. I don't choose the people I speak to because I respond to only the kinds of actions that the macaques are doing. And then select some individuals that I find fascinating. They're doing certain kinds of, you know, behaviors and, you know, kind of follow them over a period of time, you know, weeks together, sometimes, you know. And the observation hours might range from, say, anywhere between 4 hours a day to 12 hours a day, you know. So you feel that maybe you know some tiny bit about the animal now, you know, just a bit, but just a bit. Because you don't know about their internal lives, how they're interacting with others when you're not there. How are they interacting within themselves, their groups? When you're not there, how are they interacting with other animals? Because you always see these interactions happening, but a researcher, quote unquote, can only be there for, you know, you know, so many hours or so much time?
I mean, and those are questions, of course, that anthropology has dealt with for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate how you're trying to bring together, I think, ecological work has brought us a lot of understanding and a lot of appreciation for how animals are, right? Absolutely. A lot of appreciation for how animals' bodies work, how they relate to their environments. You know, a lot of that work is responsible for a lot of our fascination with animals. But on the other hand, like you rightfully said, is that there are limits to quantitative knowledge as well, just like there are limits to qualitative knowledge and the time we're able to go. And I think melding together these, also somewhat embracing our ability to empathize with and to appreciate different animal cultures, mm-hmm. is really an exciting field, but I think really important if we're going to destabilize kind of the human in how we think and how we create knowledge.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm working primarily in the archives and in historical documents, and that raises a whole different set of questions about method, right?
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to grapple and think about how I can see animal subjectivity in the archives. And one of the contentions I got back is like, no, listen, animal ethnographers are starting to do this kind of work. Right. They're really thinking through how to grapple with animal subjectivity. There's no way we could possibly try and, you know, see this in historical documents. So I think, and I'm still working through that myself. I haven't got an answer, of course, but it is interesting how the different spaces you go and the different the fields that you use to help you understand, whether it's anthropology, ecology, you know, history, geography, these really do help you to contend with it. But perhaps now we can switch to talking a little bit about the season. And I think that this conversation about methods has really, it's kind of given us a really good backdrop to start this conversation, because I think you kind of get a sense of how hard it is to know animals and see animals.
So just before moving on, I wanted to add a bit to what you said, because you're talking about archives, and that's something I am looking into further, to look at how dogs have been controlled and how dogs have been viewed in the official documents which are available in these two cities, and or like in pre-colonial times or after independence, when these all programs, the birth control programs around dogs, they came across, mm-hmm. and what were the proceedings, or what were people talking about? How were they looking about at dogs? And I really agree with your when you say that it's not about the discipline. It's not about if whether the archives are to be looked by historians or ethnography should be done by anthropologists. I think we should go through into this through our questions, and which method is actually helping us answer that mm-hmm. question in a better way. I think if we're combining these different techniques, different tools which are used by there's always a pros for all these methods which are being used since these disciplines have been there. And then if we're using them, I think it gives us a larger picture of what the animal is doing and how the animal is living. And since these animals have been there and they've adapted to the rapidly changing urban processes, mm-hmm. there is something they're doing. There's something they're doing well. So how do we reach there? How do we understand how their life is? And just not in a broader population sense, but the individual dog and its individual, its everyday activity. That's, I think, which is much more of an importance. And to reach there, I feel a lot of different methods, a combined methodology is what, have been using, we all have been using. And I think you're absolutely correct in saying that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I said it in the interview with Philip Howell, is I really think anyone interested in animals should do a trip to the archives, because how are we going to see their histories? And oddly enough, people might be surprised by just how ubiquitous animals are in the archives. They haven't been indexed properly, and archives mm-hmm. take a lot of time, right? It's not like walking into a library and saying, I'd like to see a book about dogs. You have to sift through a lot of this governance material. But I think that if you're interested in an animal, just like if you're interested in a human or in a culture, you should try to center them, you know, find out what their context is. And to some extent, we have documents that have been created by humans, sure, but they do offer, in many regards, some observations from a time gone, which is, useful and powerful. I think, like you said, even in terms of understanding ecologies, how do we understand how spaces have changed over time? These documents really house a lot of information.
And even them not being present in these archives, them being not represented in these documents is also saying a story in itself, I think, which is exactly. Very important to bring out.
Mm-hmm. And how they're represented, yeah. Right? Yeah. So something that's been interesting for me is I look a lot at tax documents, and dogs came up, but they came up, they weren't the first animal to come up, and the movement that they did on the page, they were handwritten, and then at some point they moved and they had two columns, and then they were separated by gender, whereas other animals weren't. So what does this tell us about the societies Absolutely. That they were in at the time, right? Which is fascinating to think through. Okay, so let's pull apart some more of these themes that we've seen coming up. So I think in general we've agreed that the season could have grappled more with methods and possibly even spoken a bit more about ecology. But what are some of the synergies that you saw cutting across some of these episodes? So if you were to think of, you know, a theme or something for you that really stood out in this season, what would it be for you?
See, the kind of work that I've been doing, I was trying to understand how some of these conversations are speaking to my work. One, I would say that all of these episodes were brilliant because the urban and the animal, the question of the urban and the animal in the urban is really like a broad one. It's we can't possibly cover it in any kinds of or any number of episodes. So I believe kind of introducing this entire set of themes in this season served brilliantly, because frankly, ever since we've started this PhD, we've come across all of these themes in the recording, because we see people really working on all of these things, and we read people who we've met people who've been on your episode. So and that's fascinating, because you understand that there are people working on it. But the other thing is, With the kind of work that I'm doing with monkeys in Delhi and Guwahati, in terms of the archival work specifically, again, a lot of themes around management have kind of appeared. But all of those were never indexed within management. All of those were indexed within international affairs. They were largely classified under international affairs, because the use of monkeys essentially was for biomedical reasons. And India was a huge supplier of lab testing animals, specifically monkeys. And this has been throughout the past century. It's interesting to see that there are many breaks in it. There are many breaks in it in the sense the British initially allow this kind of this biomedical use of animals and, understanding of them as this commodity that can be used to better the lives of humans. You know, that's the intention behind these kinds of animal testings. And then you have at one point the first prime minister putting a ban on it, because the animals that are going to the US, they are not being used for biomedical reasons anymore. They are being used for defense. They're being used to test defense weapons in the US. And the Indian prime minister says, this is a blatant lie, and I'm not going to allow you to take any more animals. And then there's a brief kind of relaxation in which he agrees that, so many animals will only be given per year, so on and so forth, until there's a ban on the transport of monkeys altogether in 1979. And in all of these documents that you see, captivity or capturing of animals and translocation of animals, specifically these monkeys, is very, very central. I mean, an entire discussion could be fashioned out of the different kinds of cages that were designed through these years, keeping in mind also the comfort of the animal, so to say. That is what they would say. It's also to kind of make the animal more comfortable while it's being taken from the Indian subcontinent to the US. And so this conversation around pervasive captivity kind of spoke to me, because of course there are many aspects to my work, and this is something that I feel I need to talk about more. And I mean, this conversation pushed me to think more about these connections, because I'm now in my writing phase. I'm thinking about these things, and what Nicola was trying to say, I kind of understand that not only in the physical sense, because there is still being, the monkeys are still being caught and translocated to areas outside the city, because there can be no more translocations outside the country, which would keep the population in check, just so to say. So in Delhi, there are strong practices of control. Monkeys are absolutely to be, monkeys, dogs, cattle, all kinds of animals are absolutely to be kept outside, away from the streets, basically. And this was based on a writ petition that was filed in 2001 by a lawyer who lived in one of the more fancy well-off colonies in South Delhi, the southern district of Delhi.
But what I think is really useful about Nicola's use of pervasive captivity, and I have to admit, like that interview also really spoke to me, is he's not just talking about captivity, I think, in the obvious sense.
Exactly.
Right? He's not just saying, okay, there are animals that are caged, which I think many of us would appreciate. And that came up, I think, several times throughout, you know, also with Paula Akari. She spoke a lot about animals that are being caged. But I think Paula and Nicola, their work together actually, I think there's some really interesting synergies happening here with regards to how she was thinking about invisibility and how he was thinking about captivity. Mm-hmm. Because his idea that animals become reliant on the urban and they become captive to the urban in some respects, and not necessarily intentionally, but that they are captive through their relations, and that this is a spectra of, or there are spectra of captivities, kind of melded to me with what Paula was saying about there being a spectra of invisibilities as well, and the ways in which animals are seen or not seen, and not just in the physical sense, right?
Yeah. The other thing about relationship between the concept of this notion of captivity and invisibility also comes from this discussion around more than human, right? Because when we say more than human, or the people who've been talking about more than human, they're also talking about only certain kinds of animals. Because, you know, more than human captures the gaze, the human gaze of only certain animals that are either more visible or, you know, animals that have been, at least in the conservation circles, been used to generate a lot of revenue. So, for example, the Project Tiger that's been going on in India, in my reading of this entire situation, I don't see how much of it has actually been done for the tigers themselves. It's also about maintaining aesthetic natural reserves so that people keep visiting. There are tourist attractions. And at the end of the day, you always have, animals, at the expense of the animals. And I was reading an interesting paper. I'll tell you who it was by. And they were talking about something called the less than human in the city, as opposed to the more than human. And in that, they're basically trying to say that there are certain kinds of animals that become so invisible in the everyday city, even though they are there. It's not only that the non-humans become the less than human, it's also the humans that are interacting with those less than human animals. So this kind of flows into this the other conversation about precarity and informality, right? That there are certain animals if the state would like to look at, and there are other animals that the state wouldn't want to look at. Even though the dogs are being, the animal birth control programs are being run, dogs are being caught, you know, and reintroduced to the same areas. But the monkeys are being taken out from the city to another space, which is being imagined as a haven for them, so that they would never leave that space. But that's not how it's working out. The monkeys spill over to the surrounding areas, essentially kind of causing the same trouble there rather than
in the city
and in the more elite neighborhoods, right? So they are being taken out from the more elite neighborhoods. So the problem then is not of the elite, it's also of the migrant worker who lives in Delhi, the migrant worker who lives at the periphery of Delhi.
So what I'm hearing here are two kind of different cross-cutting themes. So the one, I think, which you raised right at the beginning is the theme of management and how management entails a whole range of biopolitical interventions, but that also operate through different captivities and different visibilities and invisibilities that impact a variety of populations. And I think part of that is also kind of this idea of entanglement and that different populations are entangled with one another through precarity or through privilege, which also, you know, is related to management. Shubhangi, maybe you could jump in here also. I don't know if you want to contribute to that theme a little bit or if you've got another kind of cross-cutting theme that you would like to highlight.
What actually related to me from the season was of course, it relates to what Anmol has been talking about. It's the theme of biopolitics and the power dynamics in the human-animal relations which Kritika Srinivasan was talking about. And like how she talks about the birth control program and the breeding practices which are aimed at controlling the populations of dogs in India. And like she does the comparative work with the program in UK and India and how that works out. But what I have seen in my work here is that I try to look at this program from its beginning and how it is happening and unfolding now in the urban and in these two cities. And what comes across is interesting that it did start and did grow from a biopolitical lens, but it has moved on to a politics of aesthetics, what Anmol is talking about. It's when these programs are largely aimed at controlling the street dog populations, sterilizing the street dog populations. And these street dogs in India, they are mostly considered quote-unquote dirty or unwanted in these clean urban spaces. And which are the complaints which these municipal corporations or the authorities they get against these dogs? So these programs they are much more towards. For instance, if you look at the entire work around the Commonwealth Games which were conducted in Delhi 2009-2010. So that entire area, which the Commonwealth Village, which was cleaned. And cleaning meant removing the street dogs and the homeless people from that particular area and moving them to a center where they think they'll be safe. So these areas were to be cleaned and safety issues were brought out. And these were done under the control programs. So how this program has moved from a lens which is from a point where they were talking about controlling the population, controlling rabies as a health factor. So these factors are still there. Mm-hmm. But another level has come across, which is cleaning the city spaces in accordance with the upper middle class and above classes in these urban areas, in these cities.
Yeah.
So where they are, these street dogs are considered as a nuisance in these gated settlements, and they are kept outside of these settlements. And who want to be ridden off of these like dirty dogs? And this is this idea of the aesthetics or the cleanliness or the dirt of the dog that itself is a differentiation which people, for instance, make between a street dog and a high-end breed dog.
These are two different dogs,
I would say, different categories of dogs within the dog in these cities, because a breed dog is a large part of my work I've been studying, again this is another theme which is cross-cutting across, is the informality. So I'm studying informal settlements. I'm looking at how across social structures of urbanization, across socioeconomic classes, dogs are perceived. Is there an effect of these societal norms on the interactions with dogs in these areas? So if I'm studying a middle class gated colony, I'm also studying an informal settlement and dogs in these areas and their interactions in these areas. So then how people in informal settlements, they have a very different understanding. They say that they share, because they share the same space, they also share an identity with these street dogs, as opposed to those breed dogs or the high-end the pet dogs in these big houses, which are obviously around these informal settlements, who have a soap to bathe every day, who have air-conditioned cars to travel around. So how these people in these settlements, they are interacting, they are sharing. And then within these settlements also, you'll find people who have pets. For instance, they have mixed Labradors or they have Indian Spitz as breeds, who are keeping them. And these dogs are very much confined into their houses. They are not let out into the streets or allowed to mingle with any of the pet dogs because they'll get dirty. their fur will get dirty. So this entire concept of aesthetics, this concept of dirt, this concept of cleanliness, and combined with the concept of a good life, which a breed dog has, which a pet dog has, living in a higher class settlement, is, I think, which is also driving this entire program now. Because these complaints are on the basis of which the municipal corporations or the authorities are working now. So these complaints from the residents, from the people, from the areas where dogs... and these complaints range from like what the dog is barking at night and it's causing nuisance, or the dog is sitting on my car. So that is a problem for me. So these are the complaints which are there. Yeah.
I want to try and think about these concepts though also in terms of how they... you know, they could potentially be useful for a variety of scholars and researchers. And I think you've touched on something here that's really important with aesthetics, right? So there are important concepts that came up throughout the season, I think, that do cut across, like informality and biopolitics, certainly. But what you've spoken about here with management, kind of with the entanglements of different populations, the significance of aesthetics as a way of organizing animal populations. And I think this is significant, right? So I come from a historical background where cows historically have been removed from North American cities, and so have pigs and a variety of other animals due to kind of these aesthetics, these ideas of who is dirty and who is clean. And this was obviously born of some of these entanglements with different human populations that were defined as being problematic or not.
Absolutely.
And this then, for me, kind of brings up a different potential theme that's cutting across all of these, and that's the idea of taxonomy, right? How we are categorized as being clean or dirty or being in a wealthy neighborhood or not wealthy neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And often it's not as a clear cut as a binary, right? Or clean or dirty. You kind of have these, there are multiple kind of markers to differentiate animals. Yeah. And it's often not based on species, right? Like you've shown here with dogs, species is one thing. And I think dogs get a lot of, I think people can more readily accept that dogs are kind of divided in these ways, but how are other animals also divided in these ways, right? Like Yamini Narayanan, for example, spoke about cows a fair bit. And I think she highlighted, particularly in the Indian context, how different cows and different urban settlements have are subject to these kind of taxonomies that are shaped by politics, that are shaped by religion. So for me, I think taxonomy is another one of these really important themes.
I think, if I can add a bit, with respect to the taxonomy, this kind of categorization, this, you know, necessary categorization of who the animal is, what is the animal doing in the city, if this is refracted through the lens of dirtiness or sanitation, you know, it's not only the particular animal, but it's also the practices around the animals, right? What all human practices around the animal are considered acceptable, and so, you know, they're okay, and what are the kinds of practices that are unacceptable and hence are dirty. So for example, India has a large informal meat economy, and you have specific people milking the cattle, you know, and there's clearly a law that bans any kind of cow slaughter, except for in 2-3 states. And I think Yamini already spoke about that. But then again, the people who are doing the labor in the meat industry, they are themselves kind of kept outside these ideas of what a nice city or what a good city should look like. And so initially, there was a slaughterhouse in Delhi that was in the middle of the city. And subsequently, that was kind of moved to the periphery. And with the periphery went all the Muslim, basically community that was involved in butchering. And they were translocated to outside the city. And what developed outside these slaughterhouses were garbage dumps. And so you subsequently now have a clean city because the meat economy went away. It is now at the periphery. And with the going out of this practices around meat, which were considered dirty in so many ways, you have blood, you have so on and so forth, you know, and all of this. And then you also have the garbage dump coming around because those were the preferred areas where nobody from these elite, you know, neighborhoods would ever visit.
So I think the garbage dump is actually a place that animal studies scholars need to, it's an important place, right? Yeah. So streets come up, and I think here we start to talk a bit about geography. Like streets are definitely important, homes are definitely important. Yeah. But the garbage dump is, I think, and it came up when I was speaking to Marcus about multi-species commons. Right. The garbage dump as a place to, yeah. you know, how he used multi-species commons as a methodology to kind of unpack the variety of stories, I think, you know, one, how does a particular space become a garbage dump? Right. Like who was displaced in order to create a garbage dump? Mm-hmm. But also, which populations do you find there? Mm-hmm. Why do you find them there? And what activities? This ties back to what you were saying about the activities. Yeah. And how different animal populations and human populations work side by side to work through some of these places. And of course, this is also tied to, I think, what Catherine Oliver was talking about with urban metabolism, right? This is the waste of the city. Yes. It's the outputs Absolutely. Of the city that no one wants to see. So I think, Shubhangi, you really like hit a nail on the head there, speaking a bit about aesthetics and sanitization, because it's this idea of like the ordered city. We don't want to see the dirt. We don't want to see the mess. And I think the garbage dump, like I've often said, everyone who's doing these like climate change conferences, and you should be having that climate change conference and seminar right next to the garbage dump. That's where you should be having it. You should have your windows open. You should be smelling the garbage. You should be feeling the heat. There should be no bottled water, because then you're really, I think, at the site of things that no one wants to talk about.
And it's not only the larger garbage dumps which are important to look about and study these, but the smaller like the collection of garbage which is there every day around. Yeah. If you're working in an informal settlement or even in these middle class settlements in very early morning, if I'm going to follow the dogs, I see like outside every house there's a pile of garbage. And that in itself is very important when I'm looking at the dog, because that is a rich source of food for the dog for the entire day in that area. Absolutely. Unless there's someone who's coming to feed the dog. There are places where dogs are not fed the entire day. So that garbage dump, and then the rag pickers who come in the early hours when no one can see them also. So that's there, how when they are picking up those garbage and how they are interacting with the dogs, what kind of relationship these people who are anyways who are on the margins of the human society are interacting with street dogs who are on the margins of the dog society. So that's an interesting, yeah. I feel like, comparison. Like if you're looking at the larger garbage dumps and these smaller dumps in these colonies, wherever you go around the city, especially in Indian cities, you'll find them a lot in piles around.
Yeah.
So that's also very important to look at.
And even what you were saying there about when, you know, this says Absolutely. Something both about the dog populations as well as those folks who are using trash to sustain themselves as well.
Right.
You know, the fact that they're choosing specific times of day also speaks to the extent to which they want to be seen or unseen, right? They know, both populations know that there are repercussions. I'm from Johannesburg, and I would know on the days when you take out just your garbage can, there are people who rely on, mm-hmm. you know, materials from within those cans, mm-hmm. and they can sometimes face really severe repercussions from people if they're found digging through trash. So this also says something about, I think, the informality and the extent to which different activities are recognized as being legitimate versus not. And I think that's really, really significant and important when thinking through this. Yeah, and thank you for bringing, because it's easy to kind of think about that massive dumpster, like you imagine one city and one big dump site yeah. with all of our trash in it, but actually it's a lot more diffuse than that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I always think of Wall-E. Did you ever see the movie Wall-E?
Yes. It's all happening in a, you know.
Right?
Yeah.
Like Wall-E knew what was going on. That yeah. movie, anyway, when in doubt, for philosophy, just turn to like Pixar films and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe now we can just switch gears. Oh, before we close here, so I've been trying to jot down some of the intercutting themes: management, entanglement, power and wealth, aesthetics and sanitization, taxonomy, categorization, and kind of this tension between garbage and resource. These are some like cross-cutting themes that came up in almost all of the interviews, and certainly it's so weird, but I feel like I need to say it. Something that's also cross-cutting here. You mentioned power dynamics. This is also intercut with a whole bunch of violence, right? Mm-hmm. Like in almost all of these interviews, we came across certain violence is being done that are both seen and unseen. Yeah. And I think sometimes it's so prevalent in the work we do that we forget to actually just say it out loud. And we spoke about a gap being, a conversation on methods and how we do this type of work. Before we turn to talking about our quotes, are there any other gaps that you felt you would have liked to have seen more of in this kind of conversation about the urban?
Yeah, I think for me, methods was the biggest thing, because that's something I've been grappling with a lot in these 3 years. So I felt after listening to all of it, because it was there, it was in all of these episodes, there were different kinds of methods which were being talked about, but it didn't just come out in the open and discussed. And so I think that's the one for me.
Yeah. I think maybe some more actual like urban theory could have possibly been pulled through. I mean, everyone here did. And I think Krithika and Yamini were game changers in terms of actually unpacking, like Yamini's episode, I think, for just talking through urban theory.
Yeah.
She was just a wealth. I feel like every sentence was something I needed to write down. But even some of what you two have been speaking about here with regards to comparing cities, like I know this is a growing field in urbanism, right? Yes. In an urban scholarship that's not talking about animals. You've got Jennifer Robinson talking about Robinson, kind of talking about the power of thinking through elsewhere, that it's important to, and I think, again, this came up in kind of dogs came up in most of these interviews, and you start to see that thinking through elsewhere starts to show you that some of these relationships that we take for granted aren't, they're not necessarily taken for granted. They didn't have to happen that way. Mm. So I would have maybe liked a bit more urban theory and maybe a bit more urban economy stuff.
I think what you're talking about through the comparative cities lens, I felt that that came across, I mean, subtly through the Global South and Global North comparison, where initial interviews, the cities were mostly talking about how in the West, the urban animals are seen, and then with Krithika Srinivasan and Yamini Narayan's work, the Indian cities came up with a different perspective, with a different kind of everyday living. I feel that comparison lens was there. But yeah, as you're saying, this could definitely have been talked more about if urban theory was brought in more. Yeah.
Okay, great. So if you have any other ideas, let me know. But maybe now we can switch to talking a bit about your quotes. So I don't know who would like to go first, but normally you guys have listened, so you know how it goes. You read your quotes, and then we'll just have a little bit of a chat about some of the ideas that crop up there. So whoever wants to go first, you can take it away.
Okay, so I have two quotes, slightly long.
It's okay. This is what everyone does.
I have one from a book, and the other one is from my field diary, an interaction with my respondent. So I found it interesting and wanted to share. So the quote from this is a book is The Inside of a Dog by Alexandra Horowitz. And the quote is, the dog's gaze is an examination, a regard, a gaze as at another animate creature. He sees us, which might imply that he thinks about us, and we like to be considered. Naturally, we wonder in that moment of shared gaze, is the dog thinking about us the way we are thinking about the dog? What does he know about us? Dogs are anthropologists among us. They are students of behavior, observing us in the way that the science of anthropology teaches its practitioners to look at humans. Dogs don't stop looking at the grumpy walk, at a rush of leaves tumbling down the sidewalks at our faces. The urban dog may be bereft of natural sights, but he is rich in the odd, the drunken man swerving through the crowd, the shouting sidewalk preacher, the lame and destitute. All get long stares from dogs who pass them. What makes dogs good anthropologists is that they are so attuned to humans. They notice what is typical and what is different. And just as crucially, they don't become inured to us as we do, or nor do they grow up to be us. So that's the book quote. And the second quote is for one of my daily interactions from my field notes. So it goes as, Mrs. Sharma walks down the same street in Delhi every morning to check on the construction of her house. She has another house nearby where she lives with her son and his family. She had moved there after her husband passed away, but now that she has retired from her government job, she intended to live in this house that her late husband and she had bought together. Clad in her crisp cotton salwar kameez, which is traditional Indian Punjabi women attire, her hair nicely tied back in a bun, she passes me every morning with a smile. I presume this smile is an encouragement towards my work here. She had stopped me in between my following of Lali, a young white female dog with black patches, on the second day of my observations to inquire, and I quote her, why are you interested in these dogs? Are you from the government and are going to take them away? On getting to know about my research, she patted on me on my back with her encouraging words. Nobody tries to study them. Everyone here wants them taken away. She explained to me that Lali was very dear to her and she comes every day early morning to feed her bread and milk. Happily, Lali would snuggle her nose to her feet, wagging her tail left to right. It helps her twofold, Mrs. Sharma explained to me one day while feeding Lali. She can keep a check on the notorious construction workers in their progress on her house, and she gets to meet Lali. Later in the week, Mrs. Sharma informed me that Lali had given birth in her house. Excitedly, she wanted to show me the puppies, but was apprehensive of disturbing them, as they were already subjected to the unsettling sounds of construction. But now she was seriously worried about them. One of the puppies had passed away and the others were also in a bad shape. She was considering taking them to the hospital. She informed me that her neighbors were also not happy about the increasing dog population and had their eyes on the puppies. She could shift them somewhere else. This morning, I saw Mrs. Sharma anxiously walking, almost half running to her house and looking for something. She was followed by her also worried son. He was the eldest she had and who shared her interest in the care and love for other animals. They were both looking for something or someone. On getting near, I could hear her calling out to Lali frantically. She approached me to inquire if I had seen her anywhere. One of Lali's puppies, apparently, had been run over last night by a passing by vehicle. In 10 days, Lali had lost all her puppies. When Lali wouldn't come to her, Mrs. Sharma said to me, and this is her quote, look how today she is not coming to me. She is sad today. She blames me for not taking care of them. She doesn't talk to me anymore.
That's a terribly sad story.
Yeah. And yeah. Very, very
I
profound.
I didn't see it going that way.
And that's sort of, I mean, the mortality rate of puppies in India and in these cities is extremely high. Extremely high, and most of them, like, they give in to the extreme weather conditions and improper care, lack of health infrastructures. But most of them, I mean, this is from personal communications from the fields, field studies, but most of them die because they're overrun by vehicles intentionally or unintentionally. And I felt I wanted to share this field entry because, like, it captured all the ideas and all the aspects of this relationship which I wanted to look at. There's how she's scared, how she's judging me being there with my diary, with my phone, because she thinks that I'm someone from the government and I'm thinking of taking away the dogs. Mm-hmm. So this shows that her concern for the dogs, and also she must have come across these incidences, these experiences previously with people coming there from the government to take away dogs or to look at the dogs, whoever, her interaction, which made her judge my presence in that area as such. And then also I really like how, I mean, it's sad, it's definitely sad. And when I actually went beyond that, I could see what her relationship with the dog was, because she was saying she was looking at herself from the dog's point of view. Mm-hmm. She was saying that because she was not able to look after the puppies of Lali, Lali is not responding to her calls that day. Lali is not coming to her.
I think what's fascinating there is also because you juxtapose that with the one from Alexander Horowitz, right? And the idea of observing or watching each other. And I think, like you say, what she's doing there is also speaking to how Lali was paying attention to her and how she was paying attention to Lali. So there was active attention happening between them. And the first quote, I think, spoke to dogs do watch. They do watch all the time. Like sometimes I think people who have dogs in their homes are all of a sudden surprised. They're like, I didn't teach her that. And she's doing that because they were watching you. They figured out what you enjoy, absolutely, what you don't, what you like, what you do. But then at the same time, I think we perhaps... You speak about the gaze. Some humans pay particular attention to some animals, but the extent to which that we offer kind of that generous gaze of just observing to see what is it you need right now, or just observing, just watching. I don't know if we are as generous, or not all of us, and not often enough, I think, are as generous to just watching them in awe and in wonder. And that's also something that came up, I think, throughout the season is just look at the animals, pay attention to how amazing they are, marvel at their life. This was clearly a really difficult week for Lali, right? Yeah. Like this, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah. Anmol, do you have any thoughts before you share your quote?
No, I mean, this was just too poignant. And I mean, I was clearly taken by surprise and absolutely the kind of juxtaposition of, the quote by Horowitz and then Shubhangi kind of, you know, it of course kind of tells us that yes, the animals are kind of always observing us, but it also tells us methodologically, how can we achieve some of those, you know?
Exactly.
At least address some of those questions, you know, by talking to the people and it doesn't have to absolutely be, the animal's perspective itself, because I think I think all of us would agree that we'll never be able to capture, you know, the exact worldview of the animal, the individual.
Very difficult, yeah.
Right, yeah. But there are ways to get around it. There are ways to get around it. There are ways in which, you know, people would say how you would triangulate. You know, people would use the term to kind of use your own understanding and knowledge, and then of the other people, and then also see that Lali is Saturday. No, you know, Lali isn't emerging out, and so these are kind of indicators which tell us the story about that individual dog. It's not the story of the people; it's the story of the dog. But there are people who will tell us
the dog is leading us to.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that is something.
Yeah, and I think on top of that is also, I can't capture anyone's perspective. Sometimes I think we put a lot of weight on kind of the verbal, and dogs communicate and animals communicate a lot through what they do. Mm-hmm. And like you say, who they're with and who they entrust.
Yeah.
And also I think to some extent, trusting our own observations, which need to be held in tension, right? I think this has come up in previous interviews. The first people to say that they love their animals are also the farmers who are using animals, right? Yeah. So there is a tension with observing, with how much we can know, but there is also, I wouldn't completely throw out those observations either. You know, who is watching, your ability to watch Lali.
Yeah.
I think there are many ways in which we could know potentially what they're going through. And I think empathy is a really powerful tool. You know, how would you feel if you had six kids and they all died in 1 week? That's without disavowing also what our own cultural attachments are to children versus what Lali's might have been.
And I think it kind of also brings the question of the agency of the animal itself, you know, of maneuvering the city, of being able to experience certain kinds of things. I mean, they might not be exactly how the animal might have kind of figured, but there are ways to just talk about the... And I think because we're not talking about the gaze, one example from my field work comes to my head, where I had been observing this one individual adult female monkey at one of my field sites. And it had been 3 days. And they were long, long observations. So I'm pretty sure that individual is very, very aware of my presence. And I constantly kept thinking to myself that, you know, it isn't a large troop. It's just this female and this another adult male. And the adult female is sitting around. And I was wondering whether this individual observes me or not. Because, you know, it's just the two of us and some other kind of passersby. It's nobody else there. It so happened that I was writing notes. I had a notebook and a pen. And I just kept the pen aside for just a second. The female quickly came to the pen, inspected the pen, kind of started chewing on it. Then it slightly just looked at me and just threw it in my direction. And I thought maybe it's not that exactly. It was just trying to throw it away. But then no, she picked it up again and then threw it at my face.
My God.
So the idea is, so at least in my understanding is that that individual was observing me. It was observing not only me, it was observing the articles that I was holding. It associated exactly. that pen with me.
Well, I saw a video, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, of a vervet monkey in South Africa who... Now, South Africans aren't big mask wearers, right? We don't have a history of wearing masks. So it's a relatively new phenomenon because of COVID-19 that everyone's wearing masks. Mm. And all of a sudden, someone had dropped their mask and a vervet monkey picked the mask up and didn't just like wrangle it about or do anything. He proceeded to put it over his face.
Yes, I think I saw that, yeah.
And that's got no bearing, no, that's purely observation. Absolutely. That's seeing that device on a human face and saying, wait, this does something.
Yeah.
And the monkey was trying to figure out what the mask does. And that's observation 101.
Exactly.
That is observation, which is like, just wild.
A lot of learning behavior in monkeys and primates is through imitation. Like, for instance, if you look at the entire discussion around the trading behavior in Bali and Indonesia, which has been written about in primates and by Fuentes. And it's also there and it's also being written about in India. It happens in North Indian temples also. So this trading behavior is where a monkey would come and take something valuable, say your glasses, your phones, or an eatable or a piece of clothing like a shawl from you, and then it would go and sit sit on a lamppost or a roof, whatever, which is nearby but also approachable. And then when you give that animal a pouch of food which he recognizes, like these are sold around in these areas, and say brown envelopes or a sugar pellets, whichever you say sold around, when you throw that, and then the monkey would lose that object and it would come down to you, and then the monkey would catch that food. So this kind of trading behavior, which is being studied, is also, and these behaviors are very much learned through imitation across generations.
Mm-hmm.
So learning about your environment is a very big part of growing up in these societies. Yeah,
and I think recognizing that is to also decenter ourselves, right? Like we think that we're these great observers and knowers of things. We just have a different way of storing our knowledge, of passing down our knowledge. But it's we're not the only ones watching, clearly, which is really fascinating. Okay, we've been speaking. I do this at like the I think I just enjoy these conversations, and like I'm always like, oh my god, the time's running out.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, the quote.
Anmol, let's go to your quote.
Yes. So this is a quote from the paper titled "The More Than Human City" by Adrian Franklin. It's a 2016 paper, and he writes this in context of what does it really entail to be living around animals? You know, in this kind of the idea of entanglement. What does it really mean? And so they write, in theorizing this continuity in change, it is essential to understand the consequences of this contiguity and cohabitation with non-human elements of the city. We cannot merely leave it as a representation. We need to ask what followed, what happened, what iterations and entanglements occurred, with what consequences. One answer was that the extensive parks and gardens might have been built as representations of true wilderness for humans, or imported classical cityscapes. But that's not how nature itself was going to act on it. This quote kind of makes us think about a lot of these questions. One, the use of the word nature, you know, are we kind of talking about nature being separated mm-hmm. from the city itself or from the urban itself? Because for an ecologist, generally for an ecologist or people who are studying animals in the urban, for them, the urban is just another kind of ecological setting, right? It's another mm-hmm. kind of natural landscape. And even in my understanding, a monkey who's born in a city is a city monkey. I mean, there are going to be different kinds of affordances that it might have with respect to whatever resources it has, vis-a-vis the differences that a rural counterpart might share. But, this constant discussion about whether the city is contained in this idea of nature, or is nature somewhere out there? And, you know, is it wild? When we say wild, does it mean nature? You know, that is something that this kind of brings about. But it also tells us about that it's not only enough to look at these entanglements. I mean, we can look at them, we can describe them, we can talk about them. But we also need to see why, in the first place, did they start happening? And once they are happening, what does it entail for the animal itself? What does it entail mm-hmm. for the city? What does it entail for the human cohabitants? And in that sense, it's talking about this kind of cohabitation in its literal kind of sense that, you know, animals and humans living in a, you know, city space, kind of contributing to it, building mm-hmm. it together, you know. So, yeah. So would the Hanuman Mandir, which is a Hanuman deity, is a monkey god in India. And it was one of my field sites in Delhi. It's in central Delhi. So would that still be the same Hanuman Mandir if there wouldn't be all of those 30 monkeys that populated most, you know, on most days, every day, evening, morning, you know? Would it still be mm-hmm. the same Hanuman Mandir, or would it just be another temple that nobody kind of knows about? So it is also kind of the monkeys are the reason that a lot of people visit the place. And mm-hmm. and so not only in terms of association between the monkey god and the monkey itself, but also that certain areas are just known because of animals. You know, this is where you'll find the monkeys. Oh, if you walk down that street, there are, dairy farms that side. Oh, you know, if you go towards this side, there are informal settlements where people will be rearing chickens and goats and pigs. So you mm-hmm. have these demarcations within the city. And so would the kind of yeah. city be the city without the animals then, you know?
And I think a political slant needs to be added onto that though as well, right? Like there are definitely distinctive spaces that become those spaces because of human-animal relations mm-hmm. in those spaces, 100%. But a lot of the examples you gave there were also utilitarian examples, right? Where animals are being used actively in these mm-hmm. spaces. And I think, to what extent these inclusions and exclusions happen. Yeah. What kind of city do we want yeah. in 50 years from now? And what kind of relationships do we want defining those cities? So yeah. So for me, it's not just enough to say the presence of the animals is creating the city as we know it, but is that the kind of city we want to know? And I think, go ahead.
And then the idea here of the city, like it's been, in urban studies, how the city is thought of as a living space, living entity, and then moving it beyond, thinking of extending it towards like an interactive space where humans mm-hmm. and non-humans and inanimate objects, all of them, they are interacting, and which is mm-hmm. contributing to the everyday activities in these mm-hmm. cities. I think
I think this is also where the first episode of the season and the last episode of the season are actually really
talking
helpful.
About,
so where you know where Marie is speaking about the claim to the city. Yeah. So who has a claim to be here, and not just to be here, but to be here and having a good life, and how do we make those opportunities available? And you know, Michelle speaking about urban design and how design could make opportunities possible.
Yeah.
And I think she was really lovely in not foreclosing what those look like. Yeah, I mean, it was just a great episode with Michelle and her way of thinking through kind of, you know, saying, what could we build to create opportunities? And this might create problems in future, might do these things, yeah. but instead of designing, you know, a lot of what we've spoken about today is how animals are pushed, how they're problematized, how they're managed. But instead of creating opportunities for where they could be and flourish. And I think this speaks to your point, Anmol, about like the idea of nature. How do we stop constantly building these ideas that, that we are separate from? And it almost seems like a truism to me now, you know, and I'm sure it's the same for you guys, that now that we've been doing this for a couple of years, we're like, of course the city's more than human. Of course the city's a natural space. Yeah. But yet it's, you speak to folks and it's not, right? This idea of the city being somehow different and special is really, really important. Yeah. But I take your point about these animals defining a space as well, and they need to be given credit. And I think another example here is Toronto with raccoons.
Yeah.
Like, what would Toronto be without raccoons? Yeah. Yet people have this kind of ambivalent relationship with them.
Right. No, and also kind of slightly clarify here. See, the animals that, and I said different kinds of animals could be found in different pockets of the city. All of them at some point are just let free, from chickens to goats, not so much to pigs, because there's certain kind of, again, you know, there's a politics, there's a caste kind of caste politics, politics of being dirty, unclean with respect to the pigs. But a lot of these animals are on their own throughout the day. They just, you know, they either go back to either feed on, you know, eat on whatever is provided to them, or just go and kind of rest and relax. Mm-hmm. But with respect to the monkeys, they are just free ranging. They're free ranging in the city of Delhi. There are nobody's taking care of them. Nobody's specifically involved in feeding them. But it's just everyday people who passers by, certain people who have certain kind of religious commitments to monkeys, who have been feeding them. And so when I say that there are certain spaces that are defining, certain animals that are defining certain spaces in the city, I don't mean just the animal. I mean also the kind of interactions that they have on their own. The animals, the interactions that they create for themselves, the kind of decisions that they might take every day. It's not only because they are being read, you know,
And like there are certain spaces which, I mean, this has been talked about, like how there are certain spaces which humans have assigned to specific animals, like the animal spaces. But it's not that just those spaces where the animals in the city are restricted to. They are moving out and beyond of these spaces, and they're making their own beastly places. Which, for instance, how for their own, like based on seasons, I see like how dogs occupy certain different places in the settlements, which have been designed for a different purpose by humans. But they have refashioned it, or they have occupied it to that extent that the human would just not utilize. For instance, there's a particular cemented stairs which was made, constructed, like three step of stairs which was constructed for an different entry to a house other than the main gate. But then because it was so hot and that cement was offered a very cool resting place for the dogs, they started to rest. One of the females, she started to rest on that cemented steps. And they just did left it. They left it. They said that we don't want to like paint it or whatever, layer of tiles on it or whatever. We just want to leave it because we see that the dog is getting is feeling good over there, and it's giving him giving her some kind of respite from the heat. So how they are also making these places which were previously designed for some other purpose, but they have repurposed it, and through their occupying that space. So it's interesting.
They're claiming that space.
Yeah. And
that is part of that like iterative design process that Michelle was talking about.
Exactly.
That if designers started to actually pay attention to these other, you know, these other animals and what they need. And I think it came up with Yamini as well when she was speaking about monkeys in the city, how they use buildings to move about and how it's important to their mobility.
And it's fascinating because the rhesus monkeys, which are predominant in the city of Delhi, in all of their free-ranging wild habitats, they've been observed to be more terrestrial than arboreal. But in the city, it's actually the other, it's becoming the other way around, because The terrestrial mode of, you know, movement often offers challenges, crossing a road, you know, getting hit by a vehicle, so on and so forth. So there are these kinds of hybrid structures that have happened in some of these areas. Say, for example, a lamppost and the wires, some of the tree branches have come and intertwined with them. So that with the tree becomes like passing corridor for them. They would often use that. They would use the cemented boundaries, you know, around gated colonies, homes, so on and so forth, all of these places to kind of roost at night. Because, you know, they're also up above, they're able to have a gaze on if at all there's going to be a predator. And these are some of the more ecological questions that have already been asked about monkeys. But they're doing it differently in the city itself.
Yeah, and I think this then starts to come to the heart of what is a city, right? Mm-hmm. What is urbanization? And yeah. I think, you know, when we start to realize that humans are maybe not the only ones that are urbanizing,
absolutely.
That the infrastructure here is not the only ones that's, you know, calling for concentrations of human populations, but other animals might actively make choices to concentrate here,
yeah.
And to build something here, to do something differently here. It was the same with Marcus speaking about the hyenas. Like yeah. there's something dynamic going on there with how that city has become a city, right? And it involves both violences and becoming widths and, you know, the romantic things and also the not so nice things.
Yeah.
But all of this kind of melds together to make Harar the city it is, or to make Delhi the city it is. So, yeah, those are really, I think, fascinating examples to kind of just think through. And the work you're doing of actually watching what animals are doing and the choices they're making is fascinating. So thank you so much for giving me so much of your time today. Before we say goodbye, I just want to give you both an opportunity to let folks know if they're interested in your work. I know that you're busy writing up your PhDs yeah. now, so you're both finishing that up. But if people are interested in your work, how can they get in touch with you?
So I'm. If anyone is interested, they can definitely drop an email, and my email ID is shubha.srivastava, which will be spelled out on the website, I'm sure. 06@gmail.com, or they can also reach me on Twitter. I'm fairly active there. That's a good better way to reach. So yeah, I can just tweet or drop me a private message for everyone. I'd be very interested to hear from people who are interested in this kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the same for me. My email ID and my Twitter handle will be mentioned in the description, I'm hoping. And so I think people can just reach out to me. Would love to have certain conversations. I think I really like having some of these conversations because it really self-affirms you about some of the things you might be doing. Sometimes you need
absolutely.
Those conversations.
Yeah.
Because a PhD can, even though we're four of us and we've been doing it somewhat together, even though a lot of our questions just clash because, you know, for me, oh, am I looking at a wild animal? Oh, for Shubhangi, she's looking at stray animals, street animals, domesticated animals. And so, you know, there are certain contentions that we kind of get around. And it can be very isolating, especially in the pandemic, mm-hmm. ongoing pandemic, you know, scenario. So I think reaching out and speaking is always a great you know.
No, it's fascinating. I've got some friends who I definitely don't agree with on things.
Yeah.
We're both animal studies people.
Absolutely.
And I actually find having those conversations.
Yeah.
Because you realize what you're like, why do I keep getting icky here?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, my friend says something and I'm like, no, that's not right. And that says something maybe about my own like epistemology and mm-hmm. how I've kind of stitch things together.
Right.
So I know you're both working your PhD. Is there anything, other projects you want to tell people about now or anything you want to share before we wrap things up?
No, that's that for now. I'm working on my other publications from my own research work and the thesis mm-hmm. as of now, and soon maybe I'll write. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope Catherine mentioned this somewhere. I don't know if I caught it. But so Catherine is leading an editorial group for the Geo Journal, Geography and Environment. And so we're a part of that team. We've kind of written the introduction
for the call of papers.
Call for papers. So it's going to be, and the brilliant thing is it actually covers the three themes that have we been discussed more, today, yeah. Yeah, and less spoken about. One is that
was that all part of the plan?
No,
I was like, I know what three themes to discuss. I see what's happening.
So one is on methods. The other one is the right to the city. The third is infrastructure
and space.
And it's exactly that.
Wow.
And I was fascinated. That is why I told you I was fascinated to see the themes that have been covered in this edition, because it's just wonderful to, you know, realize that we're working towards similar things. And so there's...
You better include the Animal Turn in that introduction and say, hey, if you guys are reading this, definitely go and listen to the Animal Turn season 3. just a soft plug. No, that's really, really exciting. Please make sure that you, once that call, I know like Catherine Oliver is a powerhouse.
Yeah.
She seems to move at a million miles an hour.
Yes.
And anything she touches seems to turn to gold. So, and your whole group, the work you guys are doing is really amazing. I think your group is at the forefront of kind of these questions about animals in the urban. So when that call comes out, please send it my way too, and I'll share it via the network.
Yes.
But I really look forward to seeing more of your work and connecting with you more in future. This is officially the longest interview I've ever done. And it's just, I think it's a testament to how many great ideas and things came up in this episode. So thank you.
It was lovely. It was really great talking to you. Yeah,
absolutely brilliant. No, all thanks to you for having us here.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for doing this. You know,
this is an amazing way to reach
out. You're doing a PhD and managing an entire podcast. It's brilliant.
I can only imagine.
My self-esteem is skyrocketing. Thank you.
No, but it's brilliant. Like all the themes across the seasons and the episodes and the way you...
Yeah.
Like each episode has a different person who's talking about a different thing, but is still connected to the previous and the next one. Brilliant management. Amazing. Oh. Yeah.
Thank you, guys. For this final animal highlight, I thought that we should maybe focus on an animal that's been rather implicit throughout the season, and that is humans. Humans are the most widespread primates in the world. We are social animals who are very adept at using tools. Homo sapiens emerged about 300,000 years ago and then split into different groups with migration or through migration. When humans started to domesticate was about 15,000 to 10,000 years ago. This period of domestication is often considered to be one of the big moments in human history and fundamentally changed the ways in which many humans structure their societies and their ways of living. Today, most of the 7.9 billion humans on Earth reside in permanent settlements, and over half of these people are in cities. Humans are increasingly an urban-dwelling species, aggregating into specific areas. And this aggregation has, in our most recent history, also led to a division in labor and kind of specialized tasks becoming increasingly more and more specialized. And when I started to look up, just searching interesting facts about humans, I was rather struck by how differently these articles presented to articles that I was looking at about other animals. So if I looked up, for example, interesting facts about raccoons or squirrels, the articles almost immediately went to the biological or to the body. But what it did with humans was the same thing, but there was a differentiation between the species and the bodies. So all of these articles kind of said interesting facts about human bodies, whereas the articles about other animals just said interesting facts about raccoons or interesting facts about squirrels or interesting facts about leopards. And I don't really know how to articulate what that difference is, but for me, it's maybe pointing a bit to how we kind of view human bodies and human minds as separate, whereas animals are kind of amalgamated into one. I digress. There were some pretty interesting and fun facts about human bodies, and I'm going to share some of them with you here. So while it's true that humans are not the biggest or the strongest animal, and I would probably argue not the smartest either, humans are the best at long distance running in terms of endurance, which is really fascinating. I would have thought that wolves would have been up there and far you know, exceeded what humans are capable of. But in fact, humans, because of our ability to sweat, and our upright posture are fantastic long distance runners. Goosebumps are the result of adrenaline, and it's believed that historically we might have used this adrenaline to make our hair stand up, to appear a bit more fearsome to predators and those that are trying to get us. Our ears, and this made me a little bit sad, our ears and our noses will continue to get bigger and bigger the older we get. And this isn't because our ears and noses are actually growing, but because the cartilage in our ears and noses kind of starts to, not the cartilage, sorry, the collagen in the cartilage starts to break down. And as that breaks down, gravity takes hold and our noses and our ears start to droop a little bit more, giving the appearance of being bigger. Humans are not the only species with fingerprints. Koalas, chimps, gorillas also have them, but it is one of the features that makes us fairly unique within the animal kingdom. And because I'm hungry, this is interesting to note as well. Right-handed people tend to chew more of their food on the right side of their mouth, and left-handed people tend to do so on the left sides of their mouths. And that's it. Humans are pretty interesting and amazing animals. We have many, many faults, and we have many things we need to fix and do. But when looking at us as animals, I think we are rather remarkable, but not the most remarkable, and not necessarily the most exceptional. But like I've pointed out with all the other animals that we've looked at in the highlights so far, the next time you see a human, maybe look at the human and think about them as humans that have their own individual histories that have been shaped by thousands and thousands and thousands of years of history of changes, including things like domestication, that have altered how we relate to one another as well as how we relate to other animals. Thank you once again to Shivanji and Anmol for being fantastic guests in this final episode of Season 3. A huge thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for the logo, and Gordon Clark for the bed music. I also want to say a thank you here to everyone else who's helped me make this podcast what it is, to my husband, Oliver Hurtenfelder, who endures, I cannot even tell you how many conversations for me and bits and pieces about how I want to develop this podcast and ideas of things I want to do, to Paula Samanik, who gave me the microphone that makes things possible here, to Frederick and Christiane, who helped me update the Apple website, to everyone who's shared and liked and left a review. I cannot tell you how much that helps. And also a thank you to the folks that have sent me emails with ideas and thoughts and suggestions, people that want to collaborate and create different kinds of blog entries or interviews or all sorts of things. Thank you to all of you. I think you know who you are, and the end of Season 3 for me marks a really big moment. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I very much look forward to joining you in the next season, which is going to be all about animals and sound, which is something I'm really new to and kind of just figuring it out. If you have any ideas for concepts that would be really important in a season on animals and sound, I'm currently developing that list right now. So again, reach out, get in touch, let me know what you think. And this season is going to actually have some co-sponsorship happening from the SAP Lab and the Sonic Art Studio. They're also going to be sponsoring this season. So I'm super excited. Things are developing. Watch this space. More is coming soon. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.